This is the final session on theology and sexuality and ethics. And I realized in conversations that we have not had much talk about singles and sexuality, and that has even come up then as a request by some. And I have thought that we would begin this session with conversation about issues that you want to raise, and then I would like to make some theological observations from a Lutheran perspective about sexuality somewhere toward the end, and then conclude with a general discussion. So I don't want to start with my semi-lecture, but rather to see what outstanding issues you would like to discuss this morning. Not what outstanding issues there are, because there are multitudes, but topics that you would like us to address in conversation for the first part of this hour. And I realize that the people who mentioned the singles and sexuality issue aren't even here, so we might not even put that one on the agenda. Are there particular subjects that you would like this group to address?
Singles and sexuality.
Singles and sexuality. Any others? None.
Yes, I'm not sure how to phrase it though. One of the things that has been bothering me since we've been talking is how do you use some of the information that we've gained practically in a world that doesn't necessarily accept a lot of that information and interact with other people on an understanding of some of the things that we've been talking about in the past 2 weeks, and come to terms with other people that maybe don't have the same understanding that you do.
Okay. Is there one particular aspect that you're most wondering about in that regard?
Well, it goes across the board, I guess. I can give an example, but I think it...
And a lot of those definitions, I think,
yeah,
are not... Accepted.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Okay, let's put that on the list. The definitions are subversive. We could say they're eccentric. We call them all sorts of things, but subversive gets us into action. Any other topics?
How about monogamy?
How about monogamy?
Why monogamy? Who's doing it? Where does it come from?
Good. Any others? Okay, those are three big ones that would suffice for the first half hour or so, certainly. I would think. We won't solve them, but we might find ways to redefine what the issue is, because I think by and large on sexual ethics we're stuck. We're stuck into ruts which various camps have trodden for themselves, and by looking at some of these issues from new angles, we might be able to do some creative ethical and theological work. I would suggest that we work through these in the form of questions and responses, and we'll try that and see if it works. Let's start with singles and sexuality, and I suspect that we will immediately get into question 3 on monogamy as well. Are there peculiar issues about single persons having to do with sexuality that don't apply to married persons? And that's a very obvious question, but we need to...
Right, then the question of whether or not to have sexual intimacy as part of the relationship if you're not married.
Okay.
That's the obvious one.
The obvious one.
The obvious difference.
Are there any others that distinguish singles from marrieds?
the fact that most single people probably have to hide their sexuality because premarital sex isn't generally accepted by the church and also by the traditional society.
Okay. I'm going to come back to that one in just a second. That's good. Any other differences between singles and marrieds?
Single people can, if you're in a relationship, even if it is sexual and it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. And then if you get in another relationship and it becomes sexual, then it's kind of like until you get married, the monogamy issue isn't pushed on it. But that's, so single people, I guess, can make mistakes.
Uh-huh.
And married people are not supposed to.
Okay, so it's harder to end a marriage than it is to end a single relationship? Relationship between singles, is that?
Yeah, I guess that would be, maybe that's what I was saying.
I heard you saying is that single people, if they choose to be sexual outside of marriage and they move from one partner to the next, that's less of a mistake than if a married person has a sexual relationship outside the bonds of their marriage. That?
Well, it's both less of a mistake and it's also less of a taboo.
Right.
Aha, I get it. So that's raising the question of extramarital sexuality as well as single sexuality.
Yeah, I guess.
I'm not sure I agree that it's less of a taboo, at least with regards to how the church views it. Okay. That the church sees that if you're single, at least the church that I'm familiar with, that you need to deny your sexuality until the sexuality, including sexual intercourse or any kind of intimate sexuality with another person, until you decide to marry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How many of you were raised in traditions where that wasn't the case theologically? Where that wasn't the case? Could you describe what tradition you were raised in?
I was raised Unitarian.
Okay. And their sexuality is not, in coitus, is not limited to marriage, is that?
Not at all.
Okay.
Why didn't I get raised in that church?
Another thing that occurs to me, too, is that there's a wider range of sexuality with single people. I mean, single people can make out. Married people can only make out with their spouse, or and make out is a big word for a variety of sex activities that does not mean intercourse.
Okay, so marriage reduces sexual partners.
Yeah, for sure.
Limit. I like the word limit that would reduce.
Limits. That's a good. That's helpful because it might not be reduced in some cases.
One thing that is assumed is that a person is married, they've made a commitment. If they're not married, they're a couple, they haven't made a commitment. That ain't necessary. So,
let's back up a second to the phrase premarital sex. If you are 60 years old and you have never married. Or if you're 60 years old and you've divorced, and you have sexual intercourse with somebody, are you engaging in premarital sex?
Postmarital.
It's postmarital if you're divorced, or widowed, perhaps, and single. What does the phrase premarital sex imply?
That you're going to get married.
Yeah,
that you're going to get married, isn't it? And that's a clue into what the church is assuming theologically. And that assumption is
that we're all going to get married.
That we're all going to get married. Is that a fair assumption today?
No.
No. Was it more fair in the past?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. What are the variables that have intervened to make it less of a fair assumption today?
Women are able to stand on their own, have their own careers without having to be married or having to be a wife. As they come.
Okay.
Birth control pills. Birth control methods.
Birth control, contraceptive pills.
To change from an agrarian society to a non-agrarian industrial society where you don't need big families anymore.
Okay. Less need in at least urban areas, urban societies. Good point. Any other variables? Let's keep them in mind. Women's changing position economically, contraception and abortion and septic abortion as available in some places anyhow. The help me, I'm forgetting the change from agrarian to urban and less need for offspring. Any others? Which of these has the church responded to in your experience and responded to positively?
The latter, probably.
Okay. In what respect?
I think that thinking about food and overpopulation, there's been a little pamphlet on overpopulation.
And the restriction of the right of couples to restrict children has come into the theological, ethical language about sexual justice in, at least in the Lutheran, in the ELCA, and in the Methodists, and certainly the Unitarians, Presbyterians. So that has been one dramatic change in the theological position of the church. How about on the first one, on women's changed economic status? Have your denominations addressed that theologically? Let's take a closer look at that one. Why does economic power make a difference in the expectation of marriage? I'm asking obvious, but I think we need to say them.
Less reliance on men.
Okay.
Independence.
Not needing a partner in order to be a whole person. There's a new sense to that. Prior, you didn't feel like you were a whole person unless you had a partner.
And I think the economic power that is more available, at least to some women, has made that also more possible for some women. Has the church responded to this notion that monogamy was an economic arrangement for many women?
No.
And the church hardly dares name that, so far as I know. Monogamy has been construed not primarily as an economic arrangement, but as what?
A moral.
A moral arrangement? For what purposes?
Procreation.
Procreation and?
Fidelity.
Fidelity and?
Women
as
property.
Patriarchy. Okay, patriarchy and women as property. That was certainly a historical one.
Salvation.
Certainly in some Christian traditions and in Orthodox Judaism to a degree.
To assure the paternity of the child.
Sexual pleasure has also been a major purpose of marriage in the tradition. So now, the paternity of the child, we talked about the other day, that's no longer a compelling reason for monogamy. You don't need monogamy to guarantee the paternity of the child, right? How about the others that we just named? Are there still compelling reasons for monogamy in that list? In your judgment, this is not universal now, in your judgment, are there reasons to argue that people should be monogamous?
In a class I taught, and I asked the students, WSU, Washington State University, what was the most compelling thing they were facing. It was instantaneous and nearly unanimous.
Yes.
I know how that.
So they were saying, were they saying that because AIDS is such an emergency, urgent, desperate situation, that they would therefore choose to be monogamous, and without AIDS they wouldn't? Was that?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I really think so. Mm-hmm. And they're compelling is to find a partner now that you're going to be committed to the rest of your life, whether you're married or not is irrelevant.
So is that in order to have someone with whom to be sexual, or in order to avoid long-term loneliness?
Both of those.
Both of those.
Okay. I don't see what they were. I don't think many people take them separate. I think age may be a major cause in that shift of thinking.
Is it an intake of breath prior to words?
Well, I've thought about this about the AIDS thing, and that is, I think it has become such a focus that the other reasons to consider monogamy as a good choice have now, it's at the initial thing, it's like we don't have to worry about debating those issues because we got this other thing that we can say, this is why we need monogamy. And my guess is what's going to happen is the fear of AIDS will not be enough to sustain monogamy over time if that's the only thing sustaining it.
It seems to me that structurally, AIDS, the threat of AIDS, now plays the role that the threat of pregnancy used to.
Right.
And is used theologically the same way by the church.
Yeah.
Because both of them, both the fear of pregnancy or other sexually transmitted diseases, now AIDS, are ways of dealing with the issue of monogamy in such a fashion that we don't have to talk about sexual pleasure.
Right. We don't have to talk about all the other underlying things.
And the same patriarchal argument just changes verbs or nouns.
That's right. Except there's one major exception in that structural analogy. Remember when AIDS back in 83, 84 started becoming really part of the public discourse? And the big debate was about advertising condoms? What is the difference? What is the difference between AIDS and the fear of pregnancy in that regard? In the regard of advertising condoms.
You have to talk about male sexuality.
Exactly. The fear of pregnancy was never enough to have condoms advertised.
Right.
So women's well-being was secondary. Now that men were coming down with a fatal disease, we were talking about condoms all over the place. Harvard Divinity School, in fact, just had an art exhibit all made out of condoms. That was really, there are a lot of Unitarian Universalists to it at Harvard, so it was more possible to do that. And I'm not suggesting that diseases that are fatal to gay men are somehow not important. It was crucial that we did that advertising. But it was also instructive that it took, once again, something that was hitting men to break the public censorship of all sexuality in advertising that is other than the manipulation of women's bodies.
I think it made it a health issue rather than a sexual issue, and that is easier for advertisers to deal with. That's not as much a taboo.
Do you think that distinction was that readily made with condoms back in the 80s?
I don't know. I see it more so now. And there still are major restrictions on condom advertising. No TV stations will pick it up.
That's right. Well, that's not quite true. There are some in San Francisco and some in New York that do. So in certain urban areas, you'll get that advertising. Subway signs are where the major breakthrough was in Boston. We are in a set of issues around single sexuality and monogamy. That has been the interaction here. And we still need to ask whether we agree, Unitarian Universalists accepted though, whether we agree with the church position prohibiting sexual intercourse by non-married Christians. What is your estimation of that theological position?
Is that written down somewhere?
Yea, verily.
Right?
My own denomination, for example, the ELCA, doesn't have yet an official policy, but is relying on the predecessor bodies, and it was very clear. I mean, it was explicit, underlined, and in red print, that the only appropriate relationship for coitus was heterosexual monogamy. And that's basically in this study document now for the ELCA, although there are some questions trying to open that up. But the bishops apparently just clamped down. They are they were very upset about the attempts in that study document to open that possibility up.
Well, given that we're talking about the ELCA, perhaps it's a good thing assessing the theological position, in, if that's what we're wanting to do, to take a look at our text, if you will. And one of our major texts is Luther's explanation to the Sixth Commandment. And I don't have it memorized offhand, but I remember enough of it that talks about men and women cherishing each other, respecting each other, something like that. I don't know if they have a small catechism around. But it seems to me that...
Remember?
Yeah, but a part of a Lutheran theological rationale is in some way going to arise, it would be related to that in some way, so that if we're going to assess premarital sex theologically, terms like respect, those sorts of things which are held up as normative or as sort of life-giving principles, then are going to have to be related in some way to non-marital relations. So that the question then becomes, what is from a law perspective, that's say from an institutional perspective, what effect does an institution have on the presence or the absence of these values which are being promoted in this particular explanation?
And by institution here, you mean the institution of marriage, yes. Not the institution of the church.
The institution of marriage.
Are you suggesting, by raising that the institution of marriage is more conducive to mutual respect and cherishing than other forms of relationship which include coitus?
No, I'm asking whether, I think it can be, okay? So I'm just wanting to us to note the place that the institution has had. In other words, maybe we're doing a logical equation, okay, which isn't necessary. That is to say that marriage institution equals respect. Which I don't think is true. That's a logical leap. And if we want to assess it theologically, then we need to move beyond the law, beyond institution, to something else. And it seems to me that what is at the center of the Lutheran explanation, you shall not commit adultery, is the parts of respect and so on and so forth. So the marriage institution then becomes irrelevant theologically at that point.
I would agree. I'm not so sure that the tradition is that free of patriarchal legal definitions and justifications of marriage. But I would agree that we should, move beyond the tradition insofar as it is that patriarchal legalistic. But if we are now to say that we will not start with presupposing heterosexual monogamy as the norm as we work out our new theological ethics, we won't start with that presupposition. We will start with a presupposition of certain moral principles that should govern all human relationships that are intimate, like cherishing and respecting, then we are saying that there is no significant difference between heterosexual relationships and gay and lesbian relationships, bisexual relationships. That follows, I would think. More than two people relationships. Does that also follow?
It does, but it's a lot more difficult.
Why?
Well, because it's hard enough to establish trust, I think, between two people, and to have that same level of trust expand, you know, to include three or more is difficult.
Can you talk a bit about what the word trust comes up a lot when we try to articulate such moral principles these days? And I have a sneaking suspicion it comes up because of what goes on frequently in monogamous relationships now. And rather than fish for the answer, I'm thinking of, let me say it. The most dangerous place for women to be in the United States is where? At home. So the fidelity trust issue in relationship to heterosexual monogamy is sometimes a smokescreen for avoiding talking about the violence that happens in heterosexual monogamous relationships. And if we could open this up to be candid about what heterosexual monogamy really has been, then we might be able to get a better definition going of what trust consists in. Because trust has so often been articulated over against this violence that characterizes so much of monogamy.
And I think it's not only just physical violence. You know, I think of psychological violence and, you know, just the whole idea of you are less than I am, or you know, the violence that women feel as a non-person in those kinds of relationships. Your feelings, your wants, what's important to you is not a part of this relationship at all. So I think that violence also is there.
Yes. And then add the violence with the children. Heterosexual monogamy has been a stunningly violence-prone institution. And that's the part that the church has, up until the present, been very reluctant to address. In part because it was originally a legitimated violence, theologically. Now, I'm not saying that ancient Hebrews were more violent than anybody else. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that patriarchal control entailed always the threat of coercion if the subordinates didn't voluntarily accede to it. So that coercion is always held up as the final way to impel and compel moral agreement with this position. And we still do that in Lutheran theology all the time. Coercion is held up as the final step you can take if people don't voluntarily do what you tell them to do.
Well, and even if you don't go so far as to say that coercion is okay, if the woman does have abuse happening to her, she still more frequently, my experience has been, and I know that's changing also, is told to forgive. Mm-hmm. You know, you're a Christian, so you forgive.
Let him beat you up again?
Right.
That's Jesus.
Right. That's Black eye, bake a pie, is what several women told me at a domestic violence shelter where I worked for a year. That's what they were told by a Baptist minister.
I never thought about until now that perhaps fear of domestic violence would be the reason why couples would move into a living together relationship to discover trust level enough to make a commitment for the rest of their life. I never thought of that until now. Mm-hmm. I ain't read it in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And think, add this additional layer of complexity. Where will they be getting their expectations of domestic violence that leads them to want to have to test this out?
At home.
At home. Many of them will have been abused as children. Many of us were abused as children, in one way or another. In fact, the majority of the population in this country were physically, emotionally, or sexually abused as children. And the testing out the makes a great deal of sense, doesn't it? If the model that you have is a violent model.
As long as they remain Barbie dolls until they get married, we're perfectly happy.
Yeah. Imagine the tension in adolescents and people in their 20s now, who on the one hand know that heterosexual monogamy is definitely not what it was cracked up to be in church, where it's still held up as the paradigm of God's will for human relationships, and on the other hand, the AIDS problem. So it's an intolerable tension, I would think. And not only for young people in their 20s, for people who are in their 80s.
I was just reading an article not too long ago that was studying young people and said that the young people don't date that much anymore, that they hang out in groups, mm-hmm. and they're not exclusive in terms of dating. They may be include someone who may or may not be in that group in terms of sexual partners, but they remain in that group in terms of who they hang out with, where they go, and dating is not such a big deal. Which I say that because it sounds like a reaction to this, to the AIDS thing.
Mm-hmm. No, I think what that is the family, that their group becomes their family. It's a substitute for what they haven't had. They need support, they need somebody to reflect from. And it becomes their family.
That's a safety thing. You know, it's not that safe to be going out on dates with people these days.
Mm-hmm. The physical violence on dates is another issue. The group is a protection in that regard.
For me, this brings up the whole issue. For years I've heard the family held up like it is this God-given wonderful thing, when in reality, most families are not like that. I mean, we know that most families weren't like Beaver Cleavers, but in reality, a lot of families were hell. So, I don't know, I still think that the church is misleading people talking about, you know, the family and family values, and the same thing with our administration trying to get us back to family values. Well, they obviously don't really know what most families were like.
Maybe they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, they may.
Ooh, that's scary.
You want to get back to the patriarchal system. It worked.
Yeah, and it worked for them.
Power.
Yes, the Family Protection Act, introduced in the first term of Ronald Reagan, was an attempt to establish in federal law the patriarchal model of the nuclear family, with the male having the power of decision-making in the family. It didn't pass the Congress, but that they attempted to legislate it is really quite sobering. And it was in part the new religious right at that time who helped to shape the content of that bill. But I am not so optimistic anymore. I think that part of what's going on here is a reaction to this movement of the empowerment of women and the empowerment of children. Children aren't anymore simply malleable, whatever people thought they were. They're human beings. So it's not so benign, this emphasis on family values. Now, back once again to my question. Do you find any theological reasons to oppose sexual intercourse between or among non-married persons? I don't like the phrase non-married because it implies a married norm, but I'm going to use it for just a second. How are you theologically on this?
Well, as a Lutheran, for me, there's a question of, there's an issue here of law and gospel, okay? So that the issue of law here is, it isn't a question of, no, I mean, the simple answer to your question is no. But my yes answer wants to incorporate gospel sorts of issues which talk about wholeness of human relationship and sorts of things like that.
But, and we could get really into a one-on-one conversation about law and gospel and how that paradigm might help or hurt us. But it's my understanding that for questions like sexual ethics, we settle them on the law side.
Right, yeah. And what I'm saying, what I'm wanting is to be settled.
Okay, so that you're saying that the gospel has some content to offer us in moral deliberation, which is a significant shift in Lutheran theology in this country, isn't it?
I don't know if I agree with that, though. I mean, it seems, if unless I misunderstood you, it seems like you're saying that the law says that monogamous heterosexual relationships is the way it should go. And the gospel comes in and says, if that's not working, then there are other ways to do it. And I guess I don't feel that way. I feel like the law does not necessarily say that heterosexual monogamous relationships are the norm or the way to go or right and proper for everybody.
I agree with that.
Yeah. What I mean by law is sort of a right and wrong sort of dichotomy.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I guess I'm saying that I don't think that heterosexual monogamous relationships are right. You know. I'm not saying that they're right or wrong. To me, it's theologically, I just think it's an option. You know, and I guess that's what I'm saying.
In Lutheran tradition, the content of the law is determined how?
By the interpretation of the law.
By the interpretation of the law.
By the theologians.
By?
Male theologians.
But that the tradition is better than the practice on that one. The tradition doesn't say male theologians. It says the priesthood of all believers. And we don't use faith to find out the content of the law. We use reason. And that's, to me, that's one of the reasons I still sort of hang on to Lutheran, because my feminist conviction that we ought to discern justice by as diverse a group as possible, deliberating about what the social good consists in, is very compatible with that Lutheran tradition's understanding that it's human reason, which is the vehicle God has provided us to discern the content of the law.
But Elizabeth, in practice, that is not what happens in the Lutheran tradition.
I know. Well, it is in the ELCA now, in closer than Missouri, I would say.
Okay, because that is not. I mean, the wide variety of diverse ideas of reason is not how has not how I've been traditionally. It's the pastors, it's the theologians that determine that. But the laity has nothing to say about what goes on.
It's different in the various Lutheran versions, but the perversion of that original insight has been more characteristic of practice since the 16th century than the original insight has been. And part of the purpose of having sessions like this is to say we are in a position as members of the church to engage in the discerning of what social justice is with regard to sexuality, and not let the official theologians or only the clergy or certain clergy take that power from us. And they will, in direct proportion, some of them, to our yielding it up. And we have a good, strong base in the tradition, and it's characteristic of other Protestants as well, to say that it's we who must discern the content of God's will, or law in this regard. And it's good old heart and head deliberation that'll do it. And that's why this conversation is important for getting to that practical action stuff too. Because unless we have locations like this, where we don't just accept the tradition, then we'll simply replicate it. So we have to have the conversation before we move to the action, I think. Mike, you were...
I was just gonna have a clarification on what the law, what I grew up United Methodist, and I wasn't sure where that term, but I think I understand more after you talk.
It gets messier than that, I mean, in movement stuff by a long shot, but it's... The nice thing about that distinction in Lutheran theology is, once we set up the law, and let's say this group is going to deliberate, and we're going to say, every relationship that is characterized by fidelity, mutual respect, a sense of humor, and financial well-being, is morally licit. I'm just hypothetically, those four characteristics. And what happens? no relationship fully lives up to it. The advantage of the Lutheran arrangement is you don't, your self-esteem, your value as a human being doesn't depend on living up to those four criteria then. The grace side is not contingent upon the works righteousness of the law side. And the same thing with Methodism, almost. But that's where the confusion has come. The gospel has been largely, in American Protestantism, articulated in terms of sexual morality, which is really the pits. Because then singles are what? Damned. I mean, we are. If we aren't married, we really don't qualify then as dignified human.
Not a whole person.
Exactly.
Three-fourths.
So part of what this is to call the church back to the integrity of its own theology. Fat chance, I suppose, but on the other hand, if you always fight winning battles, it gets boring. Now, other aspects of this, I don't want, by virtue of selecting questions that will not interest me, to slant this conversation in my way. Are there other aspects of this that are left hanging, and there are many, that you want to follow up on right now?
Well, this is sort of something I'm getting from Verlon, so give him credit right now. But we talked a little bit in Sojourn about sexuality and talked about how, I mean, we've hinted at it being such an economic arrangement, but just about how you go through adolescence and then you push these degrees and you further and further extend this time where you've got to be ready for marriage, which could be like 30 years old or something. And we talked about Mary being pregnant at 12 or 13 years old. It just doesn't make much sense. And when we hold that up as the norm to be married or whatever, and then we extend it so far where inside of us all these things are raging and churning, there's a disparity of great proportion, it seems like there.
What is the reason that we have extended the age at which we say in this culture someone becomes an adult? It used to be 12, mm-hmm, in more ancient cultures. But we've created that adolescence never existed until the United States in the 19th century. We created that phenomenon, and now it is extending almost to 30 with doctoral work for some people, isn't it? It's a very class thing going on.
I think some of it is economics. I mean, there's no, you know, if you get out of college, if you stop going to school at 17, you don't have a job, or you take away the job from, I mean, there's just too many people, so you just keep going to school until hopefully those people that are up there have retired and there's a job available for you.
And that's not speculation. That's historically part of the reason for pushing from grade school to high school to college as the norm, isn't it?
Yeah.
Think of what the unemployment rate would be if everybody stopped at eighth grade.
Yeah.
So our kind of capitalism can't incorporate this many people into real productivity. So what do? We create adolescents who are not workers, they are what? Consumers.
Yes. Yeah.
And MTV is my absolute favorite it's the classic example of capitalism that doesn't really produce useful goods, but rather completely disposable goods that have to constantly be reproduced.
With an increasingly complex technology also demands an increasingly higher educated people to be trained to work in that technology. It takes a long time. I'm a person graduating as an engineer, assuming they were trained for their job or ready to go, and they said, no, you're only trainable now. We will educate you. That's a real education for some people. I graduated college, I think, well, I'm already done.
So what shall we think that because this is happening economically, we ought to redefine our sexual ethics so that we drop the category premarital as a descriptive term even? It is really from a different world, that term. I mean, We don't talk about driving to LA in the buggy anymore. So why do we keep a term like premarital?
Well, and if you go into that context of, you know, premarital was before you were 14 years old, you know, essentially what you're saying, what people were saying about premarital sex was that you shouldn't have sex with children. You know, that children should not be having sex. Whereas when you get to be 14 years old and you're married, you know, there's, now we say premarital sex and you're 30 years old. You know, I mean, there's a, you know, there's a real difference there too, when even the society when that term was used. Mm-hmm.
And additionally, 14 was still in the 17th century and 18th century, 5 years before puberty. You became an adult long before you could reproduce. Which is also really, it raises very interesting questions about illegitimate children. You had to work to have illegitimate children in the old days, except for bishops of the church who regularly had them.
Nieces and nephews.
Yeah.
Well, didn't bishops of the church, if they had babies, they did it, was part of it to, so they could, if a woman couldn't have children and they gave her children, and that was part of a, that was accepted part of the practice. Is that true?
Well, that's a no one to me.
Never mind.
I was thinking it's ironic that the biological onset of adulthood now has gotten younger and younger, and yet on the other hand we're prolonging adolescence longer on the other end. So that produces yet another possibility.
Well, what's really scary to me is that it's so jumbled up that we don't know where economics begins and theology begins, or, you know, it's so mixed up. You know, we all would think that somebody's a loser if they dropped out of school and got married and had children at 16 or 17. I mean, we've gotten to the point that that's our mentality, and the church buys into that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so what's economics and what's God? We don't know the difference, it seems. It's all mixed up.
Are you suggesting that there was a time when it wasn't?
I don't know, maybe not. I guess I am suggesting, assuming. I guess I'm assuming.
But I would suspect the other 180 degree angle on that one, namely that economics and politics and aesthetics and other aspects of culture we could name have always been the vehicles of theological articulation. We've never been able to talk about God without an economic dimension, a sexual dimension. Sarah and Abraham, think of Sarah and Abraham getting to Egypt. How did they leave Egypt so rich? Economically really empowered.
Well, wasn't that the time when Sarah posed as Abraham's sister, and so she slept with the king, and he was so aghast at that he said, "Oh, here, Abraham, I'm so sorry. Yeah, have all this stuff, have all these sheep and goats." Mm-hmm. He did that. They did that twice.
Yes. This is a scam of the first order. So here you have this heterosexual monogamous couple held up as after the fall, this is the image. She is, technically she gives in to long-term rape in terms of the laws of patriarchy. Abraham is complicit in this, but they end up really wealthy and go and settle in what is now Israel, maybe.
Going to thou likewise.
Well, yeah, but and then if we take the story one step further to Hagar, then you know where is the little God question here that is separable from political intrigue, sexual justice, racial justice with Hagar? It's just when I heard Dan Quayle the other day wax eloquent about illegitimate children, I said to myself, he has not moved any more than the church has on defining illegitimacy. And we can trace it all the way back to Hagar and Sarah. But if Dan Quayle still thinks that you are illegitimate if what?
If you're married. Your parents aren't married.
And basically,
If there's no father.
What does the marriage do? It gives the kid a father. So you can, every child has a mother. And all of those that Dan Quayle were talking about were still illegitimate. Now, just that phrase is a clue of our whole history of sexual ethics, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's like premarital.
He did it again yesterday. He was talking about you yesterday. He was talking about these elite liberals who are throwing darts at him.
Oh.
Proud of what he stands for.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet he is. But it might be possible to take up now this final of these three big issues that we were starting with. It might be possible that what we have done here is elite liberalism and that it has no practical consequence. That we've had these discussions and they are leisure, privilege, and in direct proportion to that, dangerous, because we delude ourselves into thinking we've done something, and all it is subversive talk. Is that possible?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What course of action would relieve that agony of thinking that we are what some have called, in an interesting phrase, mental masturbating?
Well, I think taking steps like last night's Vespers is helpful to me, to stand for something and make a personal commitment and then try to live it as an individual, and hopefully as an individual that will express itself in a more universal way or general way. Not to participate anymore in church functions or churches that potentiate things that I don't believe in any longer.
Mm-hmm. One can take very dramatic action by leaving. Mm-hmm. And especially by being very public about it and stating one's reasons. Mm-hmm. So that would be one thing to do.
Will that really bring about change? I mean,
mm-hmm.
I suppose if enough people, mm-hmm. the churches were empty, they'd finally say, okay, maybe we're doing something wrong.
Well, the churches are never going to be empty.
Yeah.
I was a member of a group that left a church, and we were the fanatics.
Yeah.
The church went right on.
Mm-hmm.
it didn't, we were a bunch of crackpots as far as they were concerned.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Jonathan. See.
Yeah, I just want to affirm what's been said a moment ago to make sure we don't lose that, and that is the importance of what we used to call witnessing, as well as witnessing with our feet, with our actions, articulating the reasons why we're doing what we're doing to as many people as possible where that's appropriate and helpful, rather than kind of keeping them to ourselves or not articulating them, because I think when you have to put them into words, maybe first for yourself or your friends or your companions in thought, and then for other people, it really does help you to think about them better and maybe to revise them as you go along to some extent. And I think speaking, writing are a very important part of it. That's how ideas get spread around, usually, is that they are floating around in language as well as in the example that you set. And I also believe in example setting,
mm-hmm.
not as something to be copied, but as something to be seen,
mm-hmm.
being a prophetic sign for other people. Those old-fashioned ideas, I think, we need to be covered.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe also you're taking your advice to Holden last night about lighten up and loosen up. You know, we sit around and talk about these issues, and I can get real wrapped up in them and think, oh my God, I've got to do something about this. This is so important, and it is important. But then I realize it's important to a very small group of people. I mean, it seems to me it's pretty much a white, middle class thing. Maybe it's not just white middle class, but it's tied into socioeconomics. And it seems like it's a very Western, maybe even US thing. I mean, I think of, you know, my parents came here from Denmark, and, you know, 30 years ago, several of my aunts and uncles were living with people having children, and it was not considered a shameful thing. People weren't put down for that. People weren't called illegitimate. I mean, it seems like some cultures don't have that. I also think of maybe the Black culture, where it isn't. Also, it doesn't seem to be as big of a concern.
No, but the oppression of women goes on in all of these. And so I kind of have the feeling that that's a lot of what we're talking about, is the oppression of women and children.
Uh-huh. I guess I'm thinking about the sexuality thing, and that we are so uptight about it. In a white middle class culture,
yeah.
And I don't think other cultures are quite as uptight about it.
Mm.
And in practice, I mean, all these people say things, but in practice, I don't think most people, at least most people I know, do not wait until they're married. So, I mean, you have theory and you have practice, and on the practice end of it, I don't think most people go along with this.
Yeah, it's such a strange situation, because the polls and studies that are done of sexuality in the United States, a minority are sexually inactive until marriage and after. It's a minority. And it's also a minority who are sexually active with only one person after monogamy, I mean, in the context of marriage. So at the same time that we have this theological stuff going on in church, we have widespread rebellion in the behavior of people. And just because people do it doesn't mean it's good necessarily, but there is such a gap between practice and theology at this point that it must undermine the credibility of the church on lots of issues when people experientially know that what they're doing is conducive to their well-being, and what they're doing is what the church says is absolutely sinful.
I liked what you had said a few days ago, and continue to say about threesomes. Not that I've considered that kind of relationship for myself, but the two biblical examples you just gave us are of a couple who needed, in order to forward their purposes, to attach another person. So you have the prince or king in that Egypt story. There's a triangle there. It's a different kind of triangle than the Hagar business, but there's another one. You could probably find other examples. And the reason I'm saying is that it occurred to me a little while ago that many, many relationships are sustained by the attaching of a third person. It might be a friend, it might be a sister or brother or a mother or whatever. Maybe it's more than one other one, but that many twosomes can only work, or maybe it's a child. That there's not just, the relationships are not just sustained on that intensive one-on-one relationship, but other things support them and keep them going.
And then think how of the situation of men who have been led to expect that the only way that they can be fully male is to have a wife as exclusive property and start battering her when she becomes pregnant, because the third is the violation of this ideal that is supposed to confirm his masculinity. And that's fairly common, that battering starts during pregnancy. So opening it up, opening the dyad up, could help to reduce that understanding of identity through the exclusive possession of one other person. And part of what you're saying points to the need to diversify our understanding of friendships.